Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Alan Treffler to the broadcast. Alan is the founder and chief executive officer of Pegasystems, a $750 million revenue provider of strategic applications. Since founding the company in 1983, Alan has grown the organization to more than 4,000 employees in 30 global offices. Alan is also the author of Build for Change, Revolutionizing Customer Engagement Through Continuous Digital Innovation. The book describes a new generation of customers that have the unprecedented power to make or break brands and discusses the changes businesses must embrace to succeed in today's digital world. Alan holds a bachelor's degree in economics and computer science from Dartmouth College. I recently caught up with Alan in his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as Alan discussed how the CIO role has evolved from being technology-focused to being business-focused. He also discussed Pega's model-driven platform, the company's customer-driven acquisition strategy, Alan's book, Build for Change, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. If you're a CIO of a company with $1 billion in revenue or above, please join me for the Forbes CIO Next Conference at Forbes on 5th in New York City on October 15th and 16th. I'll interview CIOs who are also chief digital officers, like Clark Golestani of Merck and Ish Sundaram of JetBlue, CIOs who are also operations executives, like Kathy Bessant of Bank of America and David Thompson of Western Union. I'll also speak with entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and executive recruiters, all of whom are shaping the technology landscape. To register, go to forbes.com/forbes-live/events/CIO-next. I hope to see you there. Alan Treffler, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. Alan, you have been in the software industry, I hope you don't mind my saying, for multiple decades now, dating back to the 1970s, founded your current company, Pegasystems, in 1983, which makes you a founder, CEO of pretty long tenure in the software industry. And as such, you have seen a lot of trends come and go, competitors come and go. And in fact, your competitive set itself has changed quite a bit from your origins as a case management solution provider to an evolution across the decades into a customer relationship management and business process management software company. I'm certainly not exhaustively describing what it is that Pegasystems does. But I thought we would begin with kind of an overview of the state of Pegasystems today. And then I'd love to maybe follow up with some questions about your perspective on how the software industry has evolved across the not so far from four decades worth of time that you spent in it.
Sure. And I can give a little insight as to how we see some of these markets expanding. The genesis of Pegasystems is really two trends that we're frankly still working on. One of them was the thought that there needed to be a better way to handle certain types of customer engagement and customer service issues. Prior to starting Pega, I had worked for some very large New York banks as a systems integrator. And there were a couple of things that I thought were really, really pretty amazing. It was the early 80s, computers were getting faster, but still we were doing things in ways that seemed both grossly inefficient and not very amenable to real customer success and customer happiness. So we came up with this idea of trying to create an infrastructure for managing work. Sometimes that's referred to as case management. Sometimes it's referred to as BPM, business process management. Though I really like a term that Forrester, the analyst firm, just came out with called digital process automation, which is kind of the evolution of BPM, which really is about how companies become digital, how they connect to their customers, how they connect across channels, and how they bring together the intelligence into the software with the automation capability into the software. Now, most recently, in the last several years, we've built out a beautiful CRM suite for sales, service, and marketing built in this digital process automation technology. So it really gives our customers an out-of-the-box application for service at the same time that it has the power to really execute effectively and execute on the environments they want to, execute on a Pega cloud where we would service it for our client, or execute on a private cloud that they might use in the future.
How do you differentiate yourself from a thriving field in the broad categories that you operate in?
Yeah, so I think we're differentiated in a couple of different ways, and we're really pleased that we're seen by the analysts and also by our terrific customer base as a leader in this space, particularly for organizations that have sophisticated challenges, that are really trying to do something special with their customers and really want to differentiate. You know, we grew up with very large, complicated businesses, and now that we've been able to bring this to smaller firms, we actually can offer them a lot of the capabilities that will make them more competitive. The fact that our software is actually model-driven is an enormously powerful aspect. And by model-driven, let me compare it to what model-driven isn't. The way just about all computer software is written today is agonizingly programmed by hand. It's like the software industry is operating like, you know, the monks of old who copied manuscripts. If you want a program to do something, you need to tell it to do it in the computer language itself. And what Pega does is it turns that on its head. It really has a very novel and in many ways unique model-driven architecture where people can design. What do they want a system to do? How do they want to engage with their customers? Using a set of metaphors that make sense to business users. And then our software actually writes the software that runs. So this whole model-driven aspect means we're much more than a sales, service, and marketing application. We're able to actually evolve and let our customers change how they want it to run in a way that makes sense to business people.
That's very interesting. And obviously, you're taking advantage of a variety of important trends like machine learning and artificial intelligence. As technology organizations, actually across industries, as organizations of multi-decade tenure compare themselves to the so-called digital native organizations, one of the things that they lament oftentimes, and oftentimes for good reason, is the lack of technical debt of the newer organizations. They are built in the cloud. They are built with modern technology. They have more agile processes and so forth. What's interesting is yours is an organization of long tenure, but one that has successfully modernized as the changes in technology have happened. So much is written lamenting disadvantage of the longer tenured organizations from a technology perspective. But I wonder if the evolution of your company in some ways equips you that much better in advising companies who need to go on the kind of journey that you just described because you have gone on it yourself.
I think we do have some very special insight into it. And being able to sort of future-proof our customers is part of our brand promise. The way it works is actually really pretty cool. You see, if we were writing our software in a computer language like .NET or Java, or decades ago we'd written it in, which we never did, by the way, in a COBOL or a Fortran, you're stuck in an ancient language with a particular style and way of doing things. But if instead our customers have their business systems defined in a set of metaphors, concepts, like what's a service level? What's the screen look like that I want to use to engage with my customers that's not written in code, but is captured as if it was business logic, stored in what we call a rule base, and then our software writes the software, we're able to change what's actually running. We're able to constantly modernize this by just changing what we generate. So when new web technologies come out, things like HTML5, CSS3, when new cloud technologies come out, being able to run on Azure or Pivotal or Amazon Web Services, we just change what we generate to be cloud native or technology advanced in that current environment. And that, if you think about it, that's the difference between having things that are archaic and hard-coded and having things that are conceptual that then can be taught how to operate in the latest standards in the newest ways. That's been core to our development work, frankly, for the last decade.
How does that color the sorts of skills you need, in addition to the technologies that you've described, the skills that you need on your team to be able to build the kind of technology you've just alluded to?
Well, it creates a high bar of expertise and the ability to really understand the different environments we want to run in. Do we want to run in a NoSQL cloud database? Do we want to run on a conventional Postgres or Oracle type database? Well, we actually want to run in both. So we need people who can understand how to capture the critical elements that will then be expressed in a way that optimizes to all those outcomes. But it does something really wonderful for my clients, So the buyers of this software actually do not have to be technically skilled. They just need to understand how to tell the system what it is they want. And then we take on the heavy lifting, the burden of automatically translating that into what's going to run in the cloud native or the state-of-the-art technology that they want. And as that technology changes, we just change what we generate. And suddenly they're running in what's modern then, as opposed to what was modern 3 years ago. It's kind of, to draw an analogy, if software was written like manufacturing computer-aided design work, people would define a metaphor for, say, a glass. Or if it was done the way that Pixar does movies, you would define a metaphor for a particular character, like, you know, Woody. And that metaphor would have certain attributes and capabilities. You could then pass that metaphor off to somebody who was not skilled enough to actually create it, but could adjust it, could make it a little bigger or taller or change its shape a little. Once again, using the same computer-aided design tool. And then you could connect it to a 3D printer. And you could actually create the physical manifestation, you know, the doll or whatever it is you wanted. You go from design to specialization to realization in a seamless path that really reduces the effort. Now, if a new 3D printer came out that instead of doing this in plastic wanted to do it in metal, we could drive that 3D printer as well, because the design has integrity that's not linked to the actual manufacturer. That's completely different than the way people do software. People do software with all this incredible hard coding. And you know, if you're on Salesforce and coding in their Apex programming language, you're as doomed to not move forward with what's going on in the cloud as anybody would have been decades ago in any other programming language.
I wonder if we could take a step back and also just to get your perspectives on the role of cloud in business, generally speaking. I would say most of our organizations have at least some deployment of cloud technology in one way, shape, or form. And it's just a question of the degree to which they have chosen to dive into the deep end or not. Some were lured into cloud technology primarily for cost reasons. And some of those very same companies have found that that has not been all that it's cracked up to be. And perhaps they had not fully reflected upon the broader value of how it enables faster business decisions and better business decisions, for example. I'd be interested, Alan, in your perspectives on the evolution of this and sort of the state of the union of cloud deployment, generally speaking, in business.
Sure. I think cloud as a concept is at a very exciting and very precarious moment here. A lot of folks have come to the cloud thinking they were, you know, getting freedom, and actually discovered that they're enormously locked into a vendor that not only controls the functions they can do, but actually has taken possession of their very data. And they're stuck. They're stuck with whatever cost increases, and you're absolutely right, these things have often turned out to be much more expensive. But they're also stuck with whatever locale that vendor is running that cloud solution in. I think the cloud is going to really evolve tremendously in the next 5 years. And people are going to understand that certain types of applications, certain types of cloud functions really are going to need to be local to each other, perhaps running in the same cloud or running in a more structured, what's called hybrid cloud environment, where two or three clouds operate as if they were one. Customers who are locked into a particular proprietary cloud are going to be enormously disadvantaged. You know, you see it happening now with some of these cloud systems, replicating huge amounts of data. And data replication, to get it local to a couple different computer systems, that's something we rejected in the 1980s. We knew it was stupid back then, but you're seeing it happen again now. Our vision is what we call cloud choice. That is, a customer should be able to run on the Pega Cloud as a complete managed service, which is frankly our preference. But if you wanted to pick it up and move it to another cloud, to the Microsoft Azure Cloud under your control, or even bring it back on-premise to, for example, the Cisco cloud that they run internally, that you are going to need that flexibility as a customer, not just to do what you need to do today, but to do the things that the cloud will evolve into in the future. And because our architecture, with that ability to generate from multiple targets, enables us to be state-of-the-art in several clouds, we give our customers that flexibility.
Well, that's interesting. I heard you say in an interview that there are a number of software companies that are more or less have evolved into becoming investment banks. They're constantly in search of the next merger and looking to sort of add to their portfolio of technology. Now, you've had some notable acquisitions of your own, including Tenna Software and Firefly, OpenSpin, Mesh Labs. I know Cordiant was a particularly important one in the evolution of the company, especially in its move towards CRM technology. What role do you see M&A and playing in the growth of your organization as differentiated from some other software companies? How do you think about filling out your set of technology as you look to potentially acquire companies in the future?
Sure. You know, I think that our approach to acquisition comes when we find either a technical gap or a group of really bright people who we think can help move this model-driven unified architecture forward. But when we go and acquire a company, we invest a tremendous amount to not just make the marketing materials all look the same or the PowerPoint presentations all look the same, but to actually get the technology to really be woven in with our single model-driven platform. So, you know, we were just actually recognized again by Gartner as being in two categories, the absolute number one mobile technology, and second in another two categories, which is also very exciting. It's on our website. We do that because we generate our software to run natively on the Android or iOS or Windows mobile devices out of that model. And by being able to do that, you know, we're able, if a new phone technology comes out at some point, we'll be able to hit that model as well. Being able to do that required us to take the antenna software and the antenna people and weave them in to our architecture. That's an expensive and high bar, and it really, I think, keeps us looking after the interests of our clients. The industry, frankly, around M&A in technology is a disaster. You know, I know that customers are frightened when they learn that Computer Associates or Oracle or IBM or, you know, one of the other what I would call bone collectors goes and buys a company and makes them, quote, unified in marketing materials, but doesn't really make it so the parts work together. Typically, the thought leaders in those firms are gone within a year or two. The products lie fallow. And all that happens is, you know, maintenance money or ongoing cloud fees are sucked out of the clients who now lost that promise of agility, evolution. I think it's a travesty. You know, Salesforce can buy all these companies and call them the Commerce Cloud and the Sales Cloud and the Marketing Cloud. But at the end of the day, they're separate systems. They don't have the same data models. They don't work together. That's frankly what got IBM into trouble, because IBM confused growing by buying stuff with actual growing by innovation. So I think that the philosophy we have, though it in many ways perhaps is more difficult than just using your pocketbook, is one that really serves the interests of our clients very, very well. And I know our clients love the idea that we're committed to independence and really focusing on them.
Speaking of pocketbook issues, yours was an organization that did not pursue venture capital in your early years. And unlike a lot of software companies, certainly software companies today, which largely are funded through venture capital through their growth. And I'm curious what advantages you saw in remaining independent of the VC community through to your initial public offering. What sort of independence it gave you or other sorts of advantages to allow you to grow as you saw fit?
It's really given us the freedom to focus on customers and focus on the long term. You know, the reality is that companies funded by venture capital typically have a 5 to 7 year lifespan before they either need to be sold to another firm, which happens to the vast majority of them, or go public. And we were, you know, by our independence and by the fact that we have a very high internal ownership stake, we're able to really maintain our focus on clients. I think it's let us make better decisions. I think it gives us and our customers the freedom to know that if Oracle comes knocking, that we're not in a position where we have to go away, like, you know, PeopleSoft did years ago, for, and lots of other really acrimonious things that have happened in the market. I think this gives our customers the confidence to buy from us for really mission-critical things. It gives our staff the ability to know that we're a company focused on the long term. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Been a lot of speculation of companies coming to purchase you, your organization rather. It's something that you've maintained is not an interest. Obviously, you've not sought those opportunities as yet. Do you continue to, as you look to the future, see growth as an independent organization, independent of other potential suitors?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think some of this came to the fore last year when Colin Powell's emails were hacked and the Wall Street Journal put on the front page some information that was in that hack that indicated that Salesforce was looking to buy us.
Right.
I viewed that as flattering, but as we said in our public announcement, not something that we're remotely interested in. You know, I think that that is part of the culture. I think that's a big part of what I would describe as Pega's brand promise to customers, that we're really, you know, quite committed to being there for our customers. And I think that's tremendously, tremendously important. Yeah, we've seen very few mergers and acquisitions by these large companies turning out well for the organizations who use their software. Mm-hmm. And that's just not us.
Alan, in 2014, you wrote a book called Build for Change. One of the main messages of the book is that customer behaviors have changed and will continue to do so for that matter, and that there are some companies that will understand those and change themselves, and others that will fail for, among other reasons, perhaps, for not recognizing the changes that are coming. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that evolution, and especially as an individual, as a company, Pega, that is so customer-centric, as you pointed out multiple times, and naturally as a CRM company, all the more reason to be thinking about customer needs and the evolution of those. Can you offer a bit about what that change, how that has been represented, as well as how you remain current as to the changes?
Sure. So, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at what's going on in the industries in which we work, both technically and functionally. And the principles behind Build for Change were that the advent of new forms of technology coupled with an increasing impatience in customers was going to really create new generations of winners and losers. And you actually see some of that happening as you look. The net effect of it is that we believe that the application of technology to your customer interactions is absolutely critical. And the only way to do it effectively is to think how to make that holistic. So to not get caught up in channels. For instance, sometimes you hear people talk about mobile first. We're going to build the world's best mobility solution for our clients. Well, that might be fine if you're Lyft or Uber. 100% of your customer interactions happen through the mobile device. But if you're an institution that has physical locations, that has a website that people routinely go to in addition, that has contact centers that might actually talk to people, that wants to interact with clients over Facebook Messenger or other social media type channels. If you are in a omni or multi-channel environment and you start building out different functionality on one channel from the others, then you're going to end up stuck where it's just going to be too hard to roll things out, or your customers are going to get an inconsistent experience. So what I would say the big change is to think in terms of end-to-end. How do I handle things across the different channels? Let somebody start perhaps on the web, then call into the contact center, pick up exactly where they were, and end-to-end from moment of touch, the earliest possible moment you engage with the client, all the way through fulfillment, because people are so impatient. And we think that that requires this idea of modeling your business. And then, you know, of course, in our case, being able to go from that model to actually having the systems literally written by computers themselves.
You founded this company at roughly the same time as the advent of the chief information officer role, a role that is, among others, a purchaser of your technology. I hasten to add that there are many other disciplines within the organization that do as well. But I'm curious, in having had a long dialogue with people who hold that title, how you've seen it evolve.
The core of that evolution has been another set of evolutions as well, which is people who are in other roles, whether they're a chief marketing officer, a chief revenue officer, or chief operating officer, being able to think of themselves as really being peers with the CIO, sharing a common view as to what their responsibilities are, so that the technology choices increasingly are involving lots of participants, and the CIOs are expected to really understand the business, as opposed to just bringing gear to bear. That sort of teamwork has led in many large organizations for sometimes the CIO to not necessarily have deep technical background, or for people with deep technical backgrounds to be in marketing or revenue or operational functions. And I think that's inevitable because technology is so central to not just an IT function, but to what sometimes is referred to as a BT function, a business technology function. Where the key word there is business. I mean, our whole vision, frankly, even from the inception, was to not sell to the CIOs, but to really convince the business people that they should take more control over their businesses and create a technology base that made that possible.
I also wanted to ask, while you were in college at Dartmouth, you were a champion of the World Open Chess Championship, and obviously a passionate chess player. In fact, one of your first roles in technology was to automate the game of chess and develop software that could do so. And I'm curious, actually, of the connection between your, if I'm making a connection appropriately, between your passion for chess and your passion for technology, the extent to which there are ways in which your mind is oriented that lends itself well to both.
It's interesting in my case personally, because after I won the 1975 World Open Chess Championship, which was quite a thing to have happened as a sophomore, I was recruited to work on teaching computers to play chess, which at that point, much, much early stage, was nowhere close to the way that computers eventually evolved to be able to play chess. But it really was what got me deeply into software and into computing. And so from that point of view, it was very deep. I think that the way my mind works really is probably informed by both chess and sort of a what I would describe as a rules-based approach to automation. Chess is not a strictly procedural game. You have to really sort of be associative. You have to look for patterns, and from those patterns, discern what it is you want to do. And, you know, I think that the computer systems, particularly with the advent of AI and expert systems coming into things, are increasingly able to not just do the sort of old-fashioned procedural computer programming like you do in Java, but to actually complement that with things that really can achieve adjacencies, can figure out what we call a next best action, can understand all the different choices and use a combination of machine learning and predictive models to take a step. And that, to my mind, actually is trying to get the computers to think a little more like an expert in chess would think, as opposed to just somebody following a rote process.
Very interesting. Well, Alan Treffler, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a really great conversation.
Thank you, Peter. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Next week, we'll kick off a new series called What Is, in which I will take on such topics as artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing, blockchain, and the like. Each conversation will feature a venture capitalist who focuses on the topic in question, as well as a founder or CEO of a business that is shaping the topic. The first topic will be What Is Microservices? And my guest will be Matt Miller, a partner at Sequoia Capital, and Jay Kreps, the founder and CEO of Confluent. We hope you'll join us. If you're a CIO of a company with $1 billion in revenue or above, please join me for the Forbes CIO Next Conference at Forbes on 5th in New York City on October 15th and 16th. I'll interview CIOs who are also chief digital officers, like Clark Golestani of Merck and Ish Sundaram of JetBlue, CIOs who are also operations executives, like Kathy Bassant of Bank of America and David Thompson of Western Union. I'll also speak with entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and executive recruiters, all of whom are shaping the technology landscape. To register, go to forbes.com/forbes-live/events/CIO-next. I hope to see you there. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.